The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
I think there are too many people in this for the money, and not that that's wrong, but I also feel that they bring a different attitude and passion to the cases, and I'm not sure it really serves a client well if they're being viewed as a, you know, product to be sold as opposed to a human to be helped.
Don Hinkle shares why he thinks legal advertising is diminishing the profession, and the importance of a strong work ethic and knowing your case.
I don't have those Hollywood looks or the deep voice or any of those things that central casting would want, but I outwork the other side always.
And how he's built a low-volume, high-impact legal practice.
One of my rules of thumb is that the best decisions we make are the cases we don't take, because it can be financially and emotionally crippling to take a case, especially high stakes malpractice cases, that you don't win.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I am Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. It was a chance encounter with trial lawyers Fred Levin and Chris Searcy when he was just a few years out of law school that taught Don Hinkle a big lesson. To be a successful trial lawyer, you just have to be yourself. It's that and good old-fashioned hard work that he credits for much of his success. He focuses on catastrophic personal injury cases, limiting his practice to devote extra time and extra effort on each case. One of his cases spurred the creation of shallow diving warning signs, now seen at swimming pools around the world. Don Hinkle sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in August 2020 to talk about his biggest cases, why he still gets nervous before trial, and the grave concern he has about some legal advertising.
Don, your personal injury practice has evolved to specializing in catastrophic cases, and among the most recent significant cases you've had seem to involve the Veterans Administration here in the United States and an old case that really came back in a different way.
Yeah, it was very interesting. We actually tried the case in the middle of the COVID crisis in federal court. When you sue the federal government and the Veterans Administration, you don't get a jury, so it was a bench trial. We social distanced. We did all the appropriate things, but it was a case that involved a veteran, as in my old case, and it's probably best to tell the old case first.
Sure.
So in the old case, I had a veteran who came in for his annual physical, and they would draw his blood, and then he would go back to a small town in Georgia where he lived, and then no one would look at the results until the next year when he came in for his physical. And at that time, it was a year old, so they didn't look at it then. And he ended up with prostate cancer that went on for several years and got significantly worse. And we had this tracking of his PSA, his, you know, prostate-specific antigen, going up every year, and no one ever looking at the results. So when we settled the case, one of the conditions with the Veterans Administration was that they would do the blood work before the patient came in to see the doctor, so that the blood work would be there when the doctor saw them. And they agreed. They said, we're going to change our system. We're going to do that. And I felt really good about that.
And that was a significant national change.
It was. And they told me they were doing it. And then they did it because I found out years later I get this recent case, and they do the blood work, and it's in the file. When the veteran goes to see the doctor, she still doesn't look at it. So you can lead a horse to water, so to speak, but you can't make it drink. And even though the results are right there in the chart, she didn't look at it. She missed the fact that he had a very treatable type of leukemia. Because it wasn't diagnosed and it wasn't treated, he passed away. So we were able to try that case in federal court and got a substantial verdict. The judge awarded $4.8 million, approximately, for the widow. It had been a 55-year marriage. In fact, my first question to her was, how long were you married? And she said, 55 years,
wow.
8 months, you know, 3 weeks, 2 days, 54 minutes. She knew to the minute how long they'd been married before he died.
What's your reflection at this point in your career on personal injury cases? Are we making progress in terms of broader change of safety rules and so forth?
We've made tremendous progress. When I started practicing, there were cars would kill you in a variety of ways that doesn't happen anymore. I mean, they had the type 1 seat belts that came undone, inertial unlatch. They had door latches that were terrible. You had things on the dash that if you hit somebody at the front of your car, the engine would come into the engine compartment. Roofs crushed. There were a lot of things that have been addressed by, you know, the auto industry, by other organizations, and it's made a big difference, made a difference in my practice. That was a big part of my practice, and there's less and less of that now. It's still out there. There are still defects. There are still problems, but they're a lot more subtle and a lot fewer.
And those are process changes that, as you pointed out in your VA case, you can change the process, but it doesn't remove the human fallibility part.
That's true. Sometimes things are poorly made and that way. But with respect to, for example, the automobiles, I had an early case where the car was a standard transmission, and a fellow's working on the engine. He asks his buddy to crank it up. He reaches in the window. He cranks it. Well, it's in first gear, and it cranks, and it drives him into the wall and causes serious injuries. And we sued Chrysler, and I go up and take depositions and say, this is easy to fix. You just have a switch that says you can't start the car unless your foot's on the brake. The clutch is depressed or it's in neutral. You can do that, right? And of course, the Chrysler engineers go, yeah, we can do that. We're great engineers. And I said, well, why don't you do it? And they fumbled around and they came up with the excuse that, well, if your car is stuck on a railroad track and a train's coming, you need to be able to use the starter to get it off the track if your engine won't crank. And so then I said, well, has that ever in the history of the world happened? And the best they could do was, well, we heard about that happening one time. And so within a year, they started having interlocks. And that wasn't just my case. There were other cases with the same defect. But within a year, you start having interlocks. And now, you know, you have to be in the driver's seat. You have to step on the brake to crank the car, even with an automatic transmission. So those are the types of things that have evolved over the years. It's made a lot of safety in society. A lot of people aren't being killed and hurt. And, you know, we're kind of proud of the progress that trial lawyers have done in that regard.
You bet. Don, you've been practicing now for 40 years. What made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
Well, Perry Mason, my brother, who my older brother's a lawyer and federal judge now. And I was a Nader Raider. Ralph Nader's organization on safety of Florida Public Interest Research Group.
Sure.
I was head of the Environmental Action Group at Florida State when I was an undergrad. All in favor of, you know, values that I guess come from my parents of making the world better, looking beyond yourself, trying to help others. And I went to law school because I wanted to do this type of work, to represent little guys against big corporations mostly. That was the way to do it. And mostly it was to try to do good. And of course, in the process of doing good, you can do well. And that's the combination that went at it. So when I started out, when I got out of law school, I called the local personal injury firms. I was born and raised here in Tallahassee, so I called Dexter Douglas first. And
oh, yeah.
He wouldn't have me. And then I think I called Ed Green and David Fonville, who had a firm that did injury cases and other things. And they said, well, you can come work as a clerk. And, you know, I'm looking at, you know, Holland and Knight on one hand. I had the grades. I could have gone that route. But I'd said, no, I want to do this. So I went to work there as a clerk and quickly became an associate. I think within a month, they had moved me into their associate's office. And I had 60 files in active litigation all over the state, mostly construction cases. But it was baptism by fire. I was in court within days of stepping into that and loving every minute of it.
How valuable was that at that point in your career? Because you attended FSU undergraduate, right. FSU law school. You truly are a Tallahassee native.
I went to Florida High, from kindergarten. Okay. So that's a Florida State
developmental
research school. Yeah. So from kindergarten through law school.
Sure.
I thought it was really helpful to have all that litigation. A lot of it was defending some commercial clients they had. But I was building the PI, the personal injury side of the practice. Ed Green was a pharmacist, and he did some medical malpractice, and I got to work on those with him. So it was an exciting time. David Fonville did a lot of criminal work. I never really worked on those cases, but when that firm split up and David Fonville and I started practicing together, it was a good combination because the criminal work was and the personal injury work kind of worked together in a way. Not a lot of timekeeping, and then it took off and we did well. So.
Sure. And then you became a named partner. You were with David Fonville and your firm there for many, many years.
Right.
He's a fellow Titan of Trial as well. And then you branched out, started your current firm here in 2002.
Wow, it's been that long? Okay. I had most of my practice was medical malpractice cases, catastrophic cases. They were referred. The rest of the firm was doing auto work, and that had to evolve into, I think advertising, and it's just the whole marketplace has changed. And so I felt more comfortable just doing what I do. I think I'd had 3 2-week trials that year. Lisa Fran had helped me on all of them. She's a very detailed person. And so we went off together to do this. So it's kind of to be in charge and not have a lot of lawyers and a lot of overhead and a lot of all that we've evolved. So
you said previously you have low volume, but they're high impact cases.
Yes, and hopefully, sometimes they turn into be worthless cases, but they all had a lot of potential going in. So that's the idea, is to have a limited practice and put a lot of time and effort and focus on each case.
Did you have a mentor in your younger years?
Well, David Fonville was, I guess, 8 or 10 years older than me, and taught me a lot, and he's a great lawyer and is very very helpful to me. My brother is mentoring in another way. And a very interesting point, I wanted to get involved with the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers at the time, FJA now, and I didn't know anybody. I was a year or two out of school, and they had a public relations committee and nobody's in charge of it, so I said, well, I'll just be in charge of that. And the beauty of it was I got to go to board meetings. And I remember going to a board of directors meeting of the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers. And I get my little cup of coffee and I sit at the table and somehow found myself sitting between Chris Searcy from Palm Beach, fabulous string of million-dollar verdicts going, and Fred Levin from Pensacola, who had a fabulous string of million-dollar and eight-figure verdicts.
And father of the Florida tobacco
suits. Yeah, two fabulous lawyers, two standout guys, the two names every young lawyer knew in Florida. And I'm sitting between them, and I have this epiphany that, you know, they are as different as you could order up in many ways. I mean, they're both brilliant. They're both great trial lawyers. But, you know, Chris is this tall, handsome guy that from central casting with his southern accent. And Fred is, you know, a wonderful guy, but he's chain smoking. His hand shakes when he drinks his coffee at the time. And he's just totally different in many ways. And they're both incredibly successful. And what it told me was, you just got to be yourself in this thing.
Well, yeah. And that started for you a very long involvement with the Florida Justice Association. I mean, you are a Crystal Eagle Award winner, which is the highest level of lifetime financial commitment. You even won the Shoe Leather Award for your legislative efforts on behalf of FJA, and being here in Tallahassee, the state capital, I'm sure you've been a valuable resource.
Well, like most people in Tallahassee, you try to stay away from the legislature when it's in town. But there were a couple years there where I got roped into doing a lot of lobbying. I do less now, but I do, you know, campaign finance and those kind of helpful things. But the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers was instrumental in my success. I would go to every seminar I could go to. The ones I couldn't go to, I'd get on old cassette tapes and listen to them.
Yes.
And even now, I do a lot of CL. You can always get an idea from somebody else and use it, and I do that. I tell young lawyers to go watch trials. I used to love doing that, and to go to the programs and seminars and pay attention, and you may learn something that's going to be very valuable one day.
And just the company that you keep, as you just explained in your story there with Lovin and Searcy.
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, you referred them both cases and have done really well knowing them to send them the case that they handled. Or, you know, they can call us. I mean, Fred called our firm with on the tobacco case, which turned out to be, in hindsight, a great decision. At the time, it was a little nerve-wracking, but turned out well.
And David Fonville literally took a couple of years off from your regular caseload to devote his time and attention to that.
He did, which means I got to handle all his good cases. So that was that was a good time for me, too.
Well, you've certainly had tremendous success in your career, obviously a board-certified trial lawyer among your many honors, listing in the Super Lawyers, the top 100 lawyers in America by the American Trial Lawyers Association, Best Lawyers of America. You've won Lawyer of the Year as recently as 2010 from that group, and you are a lawyer emeritus with the Inns of Court, a very distinguished group. Don, was there a point that you didn't think you were going to make it?
No. I mean, there were times you're paying Visa with MasterCard, but starting out, but no, I never had any thoughts that I wouldn't make it or I wouldn't be able to do what I wanted to do. You know, when you go stretches without a verdict or stretches where, you know, nothing's settling and but always determined to push through and know that it's coming. You know, you kind of say, wow, we had this great case and it went, you know, we settled it or whatever, and what's next? But there's always a next, and never look back.
As you pointed out, there are different trial lawyers who have different styles, different looks, different approaches. What's your approach, or what is your, you, do you think is your key to your personal trial law success?
I think the only thing we can control is how hard we work and how well we know the case and how much thought we put into how it's presented. So work ethic would be my main asset. You know, I don't have those Hollywood looks or the deep voice or any of those things that central casting would want, but I outwork the other side always, and I've never gone into court and not felt totally prepared. I've made mistakes. I've made bad decisions on occasion, but it was never from a lack of effort or thought. It was from a lack of judgment, usually in hindsight. But hard work makes up for a lot.
Do you still get nervous before a trial?
Terrified, yes.
Wow.
I would say terrified, but yes, very nervous. I think the day you're not nervous is might be a day to retire, because it's you need all that adrenaline, you need all those neurons firing, you need to be realize how important it is.
You can't win every case. How do you handle disappointment?
Not well. You know, I lost a trial a couple years ago, and I still think about it in the shower at least once a week, and it's hard. As a general rule, if and there's fortunately not been a lot of them, but when you lose a trial, I'm usually back at work at 6 o'clock the next morning working on something else. That helps a lot. And usually after the pain eases and you look back, you realize that, well, you know, I probably shouldn't have taken that case, and maybe the jury did the right thing. One of my rules of thumb is that the best decisions we make are the cases we don't take, because it can be financially and emotionally crippling to take a case, especially high stakes malpractice cases that you don't win.
Is there one particular case that you'll never forget?
Oh, there are a lot of cases I'll never forget. Wins and losses. I represented a young fellow named Mickey Whitten in Chattahoochee, and he was a 15-year-old boy. He'd watched him build the pool next door, and it's a vinyl lined swimming pool. And then the next summer comes, and you know, the cover's off, and it's time to swim. And he runs next door and he dives in the pool and he misses the break point. That's the point where the shallow end drops off to the deep end.
Right.
And he catches right on the end of it. And we know that because there was a dent in the bottom of the sand, vinyl covered sand. Mm. And he became a quadriplegic. And he was a cool kid. And that case I put a great deal of effort into. And we were able to get him a good settlement and, you know, take care of his needs for a long time. And you know, they would stay in touch. He passed away fairly recently, and his sister called me up and talked to me about it. But that was, boy, that had to be over 30 years ago. But one of the things we did in that case was I hired a human factors PhD, some really smart guy to D.C., and we designed a no-diving warning sign. It says danger, it says no diving, it's got a graphic with a big X over the guy hitting the bottom, and it says shallow water dives crippled. And that sign is now on swimming pools all over the world. And that was a fascinating case.
Don, you mentioned earlier about advertising and law practices. Has law become too much of a business, the profit motive, versus a force for societal benefit and change and the client motive?
Well, I've always thought you can do good in the world and do well, and this is one of the ways you can do that, is a practice where you're working on a percentage and you're doing well. You're not limited in that regard, and I certainly have no problems with that, and I don't have problems with lawyers, you know, marketing and advertising, although some of it is cringeworthy and embarrassing. I think it does diminish the profession. I think there are too many people in this for the money. And not that that's wrong, but I also feel that they bring a different attitude and passion to the cases. And I'm not sure it really serves a client well if they're being viewed as a, you know, a product to be sold as opposed to a human to be helped. And but they're advertising lawyers who do a great job and do all that. It's complicated things in the last 40 years. You know, it has redistributed cases to some extent to people who advertise more and are, you know, bigger and able to resource that. But it's also added a lot of overhead to a lot of firms that now they have to advertise because they're, you know, you got to pay for the advertising. So you got to have a lot of cases. It's kind of a cycle where, you know, everybody ends up making less money, but, you know, we've redistributed the cases. So,
Don, you are married. You have three children. Two of them are in law. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
You don't, in many respects. I, you know, love the family, and I've been supported. The great kids, and my wife, their mother, was a reporter for the newspaper, and then after we had kids, she stayed home, and that was essential. I don't know how two professional households could do it. I don't want to be step on too many toes here, but the reality is, being a trial lawyer is it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's a 9-to-9 job, and then when you're in trial, is a totally 24-hour-a-day job. In fact, when I had the kids were little, I would actually move into a hotel during trial so that I could work late and get up early and not have a baby at 2 a.m, which, you know, normally I love getting up and, you know, changing the kid and and doing that, but I couldn't do that during a trial. So it's hard, and anybody, you can have it all, you just can't have it all at the same time. And so we make up for that by being able to have really intense and close, you know, vacations and time off, and we got total flexible schedule, so we can try a case and then go spend a week at the beach or somewhere, and so it's all trade-offs.
What about regrets?
Well, a couple cases I wish I hadn't taken. A couple cases I wish I'd tried. But in terms of my life trajectory or career trajectory, no regrets. I don't have any. I don't spend a lot of time looking backwards and studying that. But I love what I do. I love this kind of work. It's every case is different. I can't wait to get a new case in. I can't wait to get on the internet and do all the medical research and all the you know, watch videos of the surgery and learn all I can learn, and that's just that's one, and map out how you're going to approach the case and the strategies you're going to use and what you're going to do. I mean, that's just a lot of fun.
Don, how would you like to be remembered?
Honest, good, decent person who cared about his clients. I would live with that. That's pretty good.
Don Hinkle, you are a Titan of Trial. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.